Well, the only thing we know for certain, 100% certain, that fiat money will continue to debase. That's 100% certainty because that's only math. The question is, what assets do you need exposure to protect yourself against that certainty? But let's just play a game. There's $900 trillion of total global assets. If Bitcoin gets $100 trillion, what is $100 trillion divided by 21 million? Oh, that's now sort of interesting because all of a sudden, it's $5 million US per Bitcoin in today's dollars.
Let's look at the two possible scenarios that we have with Bitcoin on the extremes. One is very easy. Bitcoin failed, is going to zero, right? That's an easy scenario to predict. The other one, on the other extreme, which is, I think, the beauty of all of this, is Bitcoin becomes, as you mentioned, Sam, becomes the monetary unit of the world, right? And by in that process, it will demonetize several asset classes. It will demonetize gold, silver, real estate, stocks, bonds, everything that we know is going to be denominated in Bitcoin, right?
What's up, Sats fans? We got another great episode of Swan Signal with you. I'm your host, Sam Callahan, lead analyst at Swan Bitcoin.
If you care about your financial future, you need to check out a couple of our offerings, including Swan IRA and Swan Private. Swan Private is our white glove concierge service where you get a trusted partner on your Bitcoin journey. We offer all kinds of education and research projects, as well as exclusive events to our Swan Private customers. Check it out today at swan.com/private. Also, Swan IRA. Swan IRA is the best way to gain exposure to real Bitcoin in a tax advantage account, like a traditional IRA, a Roth IRA, or rolling over your 401k. So if that interests you, check it out at swan.com/IRA today.
We got two gentlemen with us today. We got this new Swan CIO, Hafa Saguri. Hafa, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here. And we have Greg Foss, who's a partner at Bitcoin Opportunity Fund and a recurring guest at Swan Signal. Welcome, Greg. Welcome, Hafa. How you guys doing?
Very good, Sam. Great to be here. Couldn't be in a better place on a Friday right before the conference, right? So
yeah,
looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I'm just on the highway between Toronto and Montreal, so my video screen is off, but my microphone's tuned right in. So looking forward to this conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, Hafa and I were going to talk about some of his work since he joined Swan at Swan Research with the Nakamoto portfolio. And Greg just couldn't resist. We had to have him on because he just wanted to talk about this so badly. So Greg, thanks for phoning in from the highway. Really appreciate that, my man.
Yeah, well, it's unbelievable work that Rafa's done. I was on a podcast actually last night at midnight because it was a West Coast podcast that goes late on a Thursday night. And I made reference to the Nakamoto portfolio. And it's just such a great tool to back up your assertions about the risk mitigation and the return enhancement that Bitcoin adds to any portfolio. So, you know, you can talk about it, but then when you can reference a tool that proves it, it just, you know, it puts the dagger into the argument.
Yeah. Before we get like deep into the Nakamoto portfolio, Hafa, I was wondering if maybe listeners aren't familiar with your work, if maybe you could give a little bit of your background, your story, how you got into Bitcoin, how you got into Swan. I think it might be helpful for people to get to know you.
It would be a pleasure, but that's the boring part. So I'll try to...
Yeah, it is the boring part.
I'll try to keep it very short and sweet. I'll try. So yeah, I joined Swan, start from the back, right? So I joined Swan beginning of this year, late last year. Initially, without really thinking exactly, Corey and I didn't know exactly what kind of role I was going to have at Swan, but you know, the research one is one that made a lot of sense for several reasons. So now I'm head research and CIO of Swan. Before that, before coming to Swan, I actually had started my company in Brazil, a lending company, a credit fintech. We did kind of a soft exit last year. I was thinking about, you know, just spending more time coding and soft retiring, but I couldn't resist, you know, joining the Swan team. And before that, I worked, you know, for most of my career, I actually worked at Wall Street, I worked at Goldman, worked at Merrill, worked at Deutsche Bank, different capacities, you know, at the end, of course, mostly as an executive at the bank, but was a trader, was a fixed income trader, was a derivatives trader, traded commodities a little bit. So did a little bit of everything. So I can't say that I know anything very deep, but I know a little bit about a lot of different things. And on top of all of that, and that ties to my Bitcoiner story, two things I think made me see Bitcoin from, you know, I wouldn't say very early, but earlier on. The first one, I was born and raised in Brazil. So unfortunately, I got to live a lot of hyperinflation and confiscation of assets. You know, I saw my parents' savings just vanish overnight because it's a true story in the 90s because, you know, just a politician decided that all the savings in Brazil would be confiscated. That's the first time I actually saw my father cry. That's when I saw him last time. So that definitely had an impact, I think, on me. And then growing up, I always loved technology. I started coding at a very early age. My first job when I was 13 was selling software. So, you know, that also helped me. So I think the kind of like the monetary trauma that I have had on my childhood with my technology background made me, I think, very lucky to be able to see, I think, Bitcoin when I was kind of like first presented to it. Like most people, I went through the Bitcoin phases. You know, the first one, I saw it the first time, I kind of ignored it. And I'm like, yeah, it just looks interesting, but didn't do anything with it. The second time, I started paying a little bit more attention. Then I bought it just as a trader to make a quick buck. I wish I held to those coins from the early ages. Then I went through the process of buying, you know, other currencies like Litecoin, Ethereum, all of that. And then came out of the other side and, you know, became a Bitcoin maximalist.
Saw the light.
So I saw the light, exactly. So at some point and became a Bitcoin maximalist. I would say probably at least for a cycle and a half now, almost two cycles. So, yeah, Sam, that's my quick story, man. And very happy to, just to finish, to be with the Swan team. I mean, you know, as I said, I joined the team in the beginning of the year and I knew the thing is that I feel like I knew a lot of you guys from a long time ago because, you know, I was listening and reading your stuff for a while, right? Greg, I don't even need to say anything. I read all his stuff, you know, listened to hours of podcasts of you guys. So I feel like, you know, again, I'm among friends here. So it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And what you've already built at Swan Research has been incredible to see. But let's talk about, you guys have both have experience in the traditional financial world. When you look at research there and some of these analysts on Wall Street and how they view things, where do you think they, you know, mess up? What do you think they miss? Maybe not just with Bitcoin, but in general, when they're looking at forecasts and how these analysts think and how they use research to dictate their investment decisions. I'll throw it to either one of you guys. Maybe you guys can hash out on that.
I'll let Greg go first.
Well, I'll comment. Yeah, thanks, Rafa. Look, one of the things about research on Wall Street is that it's paid to be optimistic because it's paid to back the capital markets function, right? You're not going to get a mandate to issue new equity or be a underwriter in securities, either debt or equity of a company, if you have a negative research report out on that company. It's just the way it works. So you have the investment banker that's in charge of the relationship, and then you have the research analysts that put the reports together. And the investment banker typically will walk down to the research analyst and say, look, I know this company needs to raise money. Make sure that you have a positive research report out on the desk circulating amongst our clients so that when the time comes for us to bring this to the market, we have a shot at winning the top left, which means top left means being lead underwriter. You're the lead, top right is a co-manager, but everybody on Wall Street wants to be what's called top left. That's the prospectus. That's the name of the investment bank at the top left of the tombstone. Okay. The capital raise. So research on Wall Street is definitely biased to the optimistic. You got to be long. You know, there's the old adage is there's a buy, there's a hold, and there's a sell. And the reality is, if you looked at the number of buys, holds, and sells, very highly biased to the buy and hold strategy or recommendations, very few pure sell recommendations from the research analysts. And, you know, what you got to realize is that a buy recommendation may in fact just be a hold recommendation. A hold recommendation is could be interpreted as a sell. And then when they do come out with a sell, that's a pound the table sell recommendation. This company's in big trouble, or they're just pissed off at the capital markets. The capital markets team is pissed off with the treasurer of the corporation and says, okay, time to put a pure sell on this because Merrill's winning all the underwriting. And I work at Bank of America. Those are one and the same now. I work at Goldman and I'm sick of not getting the lead mandate. So I'm putting a sell on this turkey, right? I mean, it's just a bunch of, and then the truth is most of these research analysts are just glorified marketers, right? They don't actually do any, they take the company's projections and they just dress those projections up as their own and say, okay, well, this is what we're forecasting and the company's forecasting the same thing. It's a little bit of a circle jerk and it really is quite funny.
Yeah, I'll add a couple of things here. So yeah, I think Greg touched the most important point, which is they are conflicted. They're biased to be optimistic, right? But then on top of that, which is probably, you know, as important, they don't have any skin in the game, right? It's very easy to say that the recommendation is going to be for a buy with a price target. And if they're wrong, it's not like they're losing money. It's just paper, right? It's just written there. And in fact, if you actually look at Silicon Valley Bank, right, just, you know, talking about something recent, you look at the research price targets of most of the banks as the company was, as Silicon Valley Bank was going under, and you see that everybody was extremely optimistic. The highest price target and the lowest price target were very close one to the other, which is another problem. And as the bank started to go down, then the price target starts to go down. So there's no signal on that. It's basically, you're basically following the chart. And to follow a chart, you're better off, you know, just buy from the chart. You don't need an analyst from that. If you actually look, there's some famous cases, right? You know, Merrill, for example, had a buy target on Enron until with very high prices until the very last minute, right? They're massive lawsuits that they got under because of that. And, you know, it's proven that they were conflicted between their investment bank division and their research division, right? And I'll finish just telling you a funny story. Like, I always get these mixed up, but there was one experience from the Wall Street Journal. There was another one from the New York Times that ran for a while. Maybe they still even run this to this day. But one of them, and what they did is that they got the research analysts beginning of the year. They look at all the stock picks that they had, right? And at the same time, I think the New York Times is they would have a dart board and people throw darts to pick stocks, right? And then the other one, which was the Wall Street Journal, they had actually a monkey that would pick stocks, which is much funnier, right? They get a monkey to pick stocks out of a box. And guess what? The monkey and the dart, the monkey actually is the best one of them. It beats the darts, then the darts beat the analyst. So that tells you, I think, everything you need to know. And then finally, one of the things that really bothered me about research, and just now bridging to, I think, maybe the next topic, was how opaque is everything, right? So they will give you a price target. They'll say, okay, here's a price target for company XYZ, but, and they may even provide some rationale. They'll say, oh, we're putting this price target because, you know, we think that revenues are going to be X, that, you know, the growth is going to be Y, but they don't give you any of their models, right? And they don't give you all of their assumptions. So you don't know what their capital market assumptions usually are. You don't know, you know, exactly how much you're looking at growth. You definitely don't have access to their either Excel or models that they're using for all of that. And why is that a problem? It's not because it would be better if I could verify everything. But most important is if you've done at any time a discounted cash flow analysis, what you know is that it's extremely sensitive to several variables. If you change one variable, you can get to whatever you want, right? So they have a lot of leeway here to get prices to whatever they want and justify the prices, right? Interest rates, for example, would have huge impact. Growth, of course, would have massive impact and so on. And not showing these things, I think, for whoever is reading the research pieces is a massive problem. You know, it shouldn't be that way.
I concur. Yeah. Sorry, Sam, I'll jump in and just say, you know, what's interesting, Rafa, is that many of the equity analysts don't even consider within the same sell side research group, you can have a bond credit analyst with a markedly different outlook for the same company that the equity analyst has, okay? And the equity analyst doesn't even talk to the credit analyst about the visions for cash flow, about the visions for growth, about the prices that the bonds trade at. So Rafa mentioned, you know, you can consider what is the proper discount rate to use on a DCF cash flow model. And they will arbitrarily put in, let's say, a discount rate of 6% when the bonds of the same company are trading at 10% or higher. Obviously, you're not supposed to discount equity cash flows at a 6% rate when the bonds are trading at a much higher yield, right? And this is just how the equity guys don't talk to the credit guys frequently. The equity analysts on the street will talk to the other equity analysts on the street and say, hey, what's your price target on XYZ company? Okay, I don't want to be too much of an outlier. So if you have a buy with a price target of $20, I'm going to be a buy with a price target of $18. They don't even talk to the credit guys. Those guys live in another world, in my opinion, a much smarter world than the equity guys. But it's really a clubby environment, very different than how things should actually be done on a true research basis.
Yep.
Yeah, so they're not talking to each other. They're kind of just patting each other on the back, whether the investment bankers want them to. And then they're super opaque with their models. And so, Hafa, you wanted to change that with Swan Research. You wanted to do things a little differently. And so you built the Nakamoto Portfolio, which is a website. Any listener can go to nakamotoportfolio.com, check it out. But how is that different when you think about the research that you're building now versus what traditional Wall Street research does?
Yeah, you know, first of all, this is still something on its infancy, right? It's very, very small. It was just started. It actually was almost kind of born, I don't know, prematurely, because we were thinking about launching this thing in different ways, right? You and I actually talked about maybe we'll write something about this at some point, right? So it was born out a little bit out of necessity, but also it got traction very quickly. So that I think gave us a signal that, okay, maybe we are heading, there's something here, we're heading in the right direction, let's go with this. So Swan Research, right, the first time that I started thinking about, you know, putting something together like this, I had all of these things in my mind. I thought, well, why not do something where instead of, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, one of the things that I did also in the past is I've contributed to some open source software, like in Bitcoin including, right? So very familiar with the open source community. When I actually didn't study computer science when I was at university. I went to do economics, huge mistake, but you know, we all have our mistakes. But after I came back to Brazil, one of the things that I wanted to do was to really learn computer science. So I found something called the Open Source Society University. It's an open source university on computer science. They have a full course beginning to the end. The criteria is that all the courses that they offer are free. They're all online. They need to be available for a certain time. And they are high quality courses. Like they have, I remember taking like courses from Harvard, different universities, very well put in place. And so again, that kind of like stayed in my mind, you know, and then I started working in some open source projects. So when I started doing research, I said, well, why not do this in the same sort of way, right? We'll do this with the open source ETHs in mind, which by the way, is very linked and very in line with the Bitcoin ETHs, right? Which is everything is here available to you, verify if you want to, with as much transparency as we could allow. So the first principle that I had in mind when creating the Swan Research was exactly that, to reflect the open source ethos. I think that makes a lot of sense. The second one is not to focus too much on models, right? Because we keep saying, oh, I built a model, there's this model, there's that model, and I will say that. But when we say that, we're not really thinking about the models, we're thinking more about frameworks. So these are things that we will put out there to help you understand, you know, exactly what we just said. What kind of variables are important to, you know, either for Bitcoin price or for adoption or whatever it is, but to show the sensitivity of these variables and how they can impact price, you know, one way or the other. And I think following that, we also don't want to have any price targets, right? I think, you know, again, I've been a trader for a long time in my career, and maybe it's me, but I don't think anybody can pick prices and, you know, pinpoint exact prices on time. It's very, very hard to be. I've seen, you know, my share of traders, and they will last a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then they're gone on average, right? And then you can't really separate what's luck from actually what's skill. So we will avoid as much as we can create price targets, even in the models that we will have some kind of price target, because, you know, the model has to output something. We'll create different scenarios and we'll make it available so people can change. So providing, being open source and providing the code is not enough, because unfortunately there are a lot of people that still don't know how to code. So, you know, what we try to do also with all of these pieces is to provide some kind of app that, you know, whoever is reading the research, they can go in there and they can use the app and then can, you know, just move sliders up and down and see what would happen, change all the variables, right? They can change CDS spread to whatever they think is right. They can change interest rates, whatever they think is right. And this is all available on the Nakamoto Portfolio website as well. And then, you know, finally, this is, I don't think I need to say this, but this is the Bitcoin only, right? So makes it very focused. We're never going to be talking about anything else, right? I mean, we may talk about the world economy, but that's reflected on Bitcoin in our view, right? So that's our goal and our purpose. Yeah. at Swan Research, and then Nakamoto Portfolio was kind of like the first pillar under Swan Research. The reason why we started with portfolio analytics is because, you know, first of all, it's something that a lot of our clients have been asking us to provide, so it makes a lot of sense. But then second, you know, for a decision to allocate to Bitcoin is never done in isolation. It always comes together with, you know, whatever you have in terms of income, of other assets, how does it fit? You know, should I buy $1,000 of Bitcoin? Should I buy 10,000? Should I buy a million, right? It depends on how much you have. It depends on your situation. So it made a lot of sense to start from that perspective. And this morphed, I think, and then, you know, I'll stop here. We can talk more about this, but this morphed a little bit into something that I think it's becoming like a Trojan horse for traditional finance, because now we're speaking their language, right? So even though we built this for Bitcoiners, now we have a language that I think it's a universal language for traditional finance. They can look at this, has the numbers that they understand, the metrics they understand, the way they understand. Very hard for them when you come with these solutions to say, well, Bitcoin doesn't fit in my portfolio, right? Because you just proved using their language that it does.
Yeah, and like portfolio analytics, just to talk people through it a little bit, it's on the website, and you can basically customize a portfolio. You can put in inputs of anything you want of a diversified portfolio, and you can include Bitcoin in there. Whether that's a 1%, 5%, 10%, 20% allocation, but you can see how it impacts the overall performance and the risk-adjusted returns of the portfolio over certain time frames. And that tool can be really powerful when you're looking at, if you're an institutional investor and you're trying to decide if you want to allocate to Bitcoin. And right now people, I feel like they think they're diversified, right? They think, hey, we have stocks, we have bonds, we have real estate, but they're all, you know, the unit of account of all those things are fiat. And so they're not really diversified that much at all. And then you have like institutions like the Canadian Pension Funds, FOSS, that are making all these crazy investments. You know, they're even, they invested in FTX even and took a huge loss on that. They're going into hedge funds and private equity funds trying to chase yield over the last couple of years. When you walk into, say, any kind of institutional investors and you have this tool now that you can show them, how important is that for you in your job, maybe even at the Bitcoin Opportunity?
Well, yeah, it is extremely valuable because to reiterate, as Rafa said, it is talking their language. And this is a tool that they understand the outputs. They understand things like Sharpe ratio. They understand volatility, value at risk. They understand drawdowns. Okay, this is a in the hedge fund community, it's a major consideration is what's the maximum drawdown. When do you rebalance the portfolio? All of these things are variables in the excellent model, the open source model. And just with reference to the Canadian pension plans, let's make sure that we understand that the Canadian pension plans are really some of the most, I'm going to use the word esoteric investors in the world. They are very clubby. They don't break out of the mold. If there's really only 40 pension plans in Canada that matter, and they all look and navel gaze at what the biggest guys are doing. They all look at what Ontario Teachers are doing. They're looking at what Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec, that's the CDPQ, that's the biggest pension plan in Quebec. And they're all looking and they say, oh, if nobody else ventures off the diversified asset platform, then I don't have to because my job is secure. It's fine if we all go down the toilet and circle the drain together, but I'm not going to be an outlier. They don't want to be the one that goes and reaches for that new asset class. I saw this in high yield bonds. You guys may know that that's where I got my start 30 years ago. I was one of the first high yield bond traders in Canada that traded a portfolio using bank capital. That prior to that, it was all an agency basis. There was no principal risk taking in the junk bond area. But over time, we developed a market in Canada that up until that point had only been used in the United States on a new issue basis. So there was a huge issuer in Canada. The name was Rogers Communication. And many people don't understand that Rogers, Ted Rogers, was actually the largest high-yield bond borrower in the world, Sam. Not in Canada. He was the largest high-yield bond borrower in the world. And Merrill Lynch had the treasurer of Rogers under their belt. They were bringing a one-way issuance out of Canada into the U.S. high-yield market for Rogers Communications, such that Rogers was the biggest borrower in the entire world. I need to stress that. Now, Canadians wouldn't buy the high-yield bonds because the bonds were too risky, yet the idiot Canadian accounts owned the equity, okay? So here's the funny thing. How is the equity less risky than the bonds when the bonds have a prior claim in the capital structure? Well, these fucking retards, okay, yeah, managing money at the Canadian pension plans convinced themselves that the junk bonds were riskier than the equity. And I actually had this conversation with a very large account when I was on the trading floor. I hit the key and I go, we're trying to bring account XYZ. We're trying to bring a new issue Rogers Communications bond based in Canadian dollars because all the U.S. issuance of Rogers was in U.S. dollars and Rogers had no U.S. dollar revenue. So they had to have currency swaps in place to hedge their U.S. high yield borrowing. So we wanted to bring Canadian issue. I said, well, a good place to start would be one of the large Canadian pension plans that have, or asset managers that have equity exposure. So I hit the key. I call up, hey, we're bringing a Rogers Communications issue. You guys own $900 million of the common stock. How much can I put you down for the junk bond issue? We can't buy it. Why? Because it's a junk bond. Well, we're bringing it with a 10% coupon. You know that that looks attractive relative to the equity that pays no dividend. No, we can't do it. It's a junk bond. I'm like, okay, clearly it's a question of price. What if it was a 15% yield, not a 10% yield? I still couldn't buy it. So then I started to get upset. I said, well, what if I gave you the bond for free? Would you take the bond for free just to prove that you're at least smart enough to take the bond for free? And they said, no, we wouldn't even take the bond for free because then we would have to report to our investment committee that we owned a junk bond. At this point, I said, you guys are the stupidest fucking asset manager I've ever met in my life. And that salesman on the desk is like, Foss, get off the phone. This is one of my most important accounts. And I'm like, fuck you, Andy. These guys are fucking morons and they're managing money on behalf of Canadians. So anyway, that was a bit of a funny story. And yeah, the same thing is going to happen very clearly. The same thing is going to happen with Bitcoin. And the Canadian pension plans will be the last ones to buy Bitcoin. But what have they bought so far? Oh, yeah. They bought Celsius and they bought FTX. It is really pathetic.
Yeah, well, they need it sounds like these pensions really need clear tools, you know, the clearest tools to show them what's going on here. And so the portfolio analytics tool, Hafa, it really shows that every single portfolio really could benefit from some kind of Bitcoin allocation due to its uncorrelated nature to increase the risk-adjusted returns of a portfolio. So, and I think when you look at investors right now, a lot of them are cash heavy or in, you know, cash like equivalents, like say money market funds or T-bills that are paying out 5%. And what would you say to some of those investors who might be in these, you know, heavy cash positions or T-bills and are maybe thinking about a Bitcoin allocation for the first time? What maybe some things that you would say to those guys?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because you would think that Bitcoin would probably fit better in a for a high risk investor, right? You think, okay, the guy that is already buying venture capital, private equity, this is the guy that's going to have more appetite for Bitcoin. It's been very interesting that actually I think the best conversations we are having around this, it's exactly the opposite. It's with the clients are very, you know, like the corporation that has a lot of cash. And I'll tell you why. There are a couple of reasons for this. But before that, I think, you know, if you look at the tool that that it's there available at Nakamoto Portfolio, I can tell you, you know, that tool is already better than what I had at Goldman to use, right? And that of course, wasn't open source. Probably has many more bugs than the one that I had at Goldman as well, but we'll fix that with time, right? I think as Greg was saying, asset allocation is an art, right? At the end of the day, there's so much psychology behind it also in terms of, you know, what you should have in your portfolio, and then people get personal with their investments, right? So it's very complicated. But just going back here to the asset allocation, I'll tell you, like, you know, I'll give you a story, like a conversation we had last week with an investor, very cash heavy. You know, think about something like a corporation that has a very big treasury. The treasury is sitting in treasuries, right? So because it needs to be in treasuries, it's cash that they need to pay expenses, operating expenses of the company. They can't be putting that too much at risk. Now, there's they have a situation now that it's feels very good, but it's also probably temporary and very atypical, which is they're rolling 3-month treasuries, which now it's yielding more than 5%, which is good, feels good, right? They said, oh, this feels really good. You know, our cash is yielding us 5% a year, you know, just sitting there. But then I told him, like, yeah, but you know, this is, it's transitory. You move back, right? And you look at in the past, 3-month treasuries were at zero pretty much from 2009 to 2016, right? And they were at zero again from 2020 to 2022. And most probably, I can tell you, we're not heading to a world, unless we have extreme hyperinflation, which will give you another problem. But I can guarantee you that the real rates are not going to be significantly higher than they are. They're most probably going to be much lower than they are right now. This is going to change. So why not use that yield that you have to maybe, you know, create an allocation to a riskier asset, right? So what you could do is, and then it feels a little bit like using house money, right? Because they're using the dividend that they're receiving every month. And so instead of reinvesting that in treasuries, we'll put that in Bitcoin. And before that, of course, we had a conversation around why Bitcoin would fit. Because the first question that they had, as Greg was mentioning, was, well, Bitcoin is definitely going to increase significantly the drawdown on my portfolio, right? So what I did is that I ran the numbers just of their portfolio in the past, and I saw that, you know, in periods of extremely high, because these guys are not only in treasuries, they actually have some money market funds that have a little bit more duration. So they've seen drops of like 3%, 5% on their portfolio a long time, right? Which is very little, but for a cash position, it's not that small also, right? So I showed that to them. They were a little surprised. Like, yeah, actually, we never thought about this because, you know, we're looking at this day to day. We don't stop to see what the drawdown was. So they appreciated that. And then I did the phone. Then I added, so let's see what happens if you add 1% Bitcoin to this portfolio. How much does it increase? So that's 3% drop down in that period went to a 4.5% drop down. So, and this is in a period that Bitcoin is down like 80%, something like that. So it's not significant at all in their overall portfolio. But then on the flip side, when they look at the upside, right, and they see the potential that the Bitcoin could have in their portfolio, even with rebalancing where you're selling Bitcoin out of the portfolio every quarter, the risk-adjusted returns just get improved significantly from where they were. And the overall returns also improve significantly because in a treasury, a long-term money market and treasury portfolio, you know, their historical returns were something around 1.5% per annum. If you added Bitcoin, they went to like 3% per annum. So they doubled their return by adding, you know, less than a 1% position to Bitcoin. And they were just shocked by to see that, right? And I say, okay, so, well, but maybe the future is not going to be like the past. Well, maybe that's a very fair point. So let's look at the periods where Bitcoin didn't perform. And we looked at that. And by the end of the conversation, they were looking like, yeah, this makes sense because Bitcoin, first of all, you know, of course, it's a very has very good returns. But also, and more importantly, it's extremely uncorrelated, as it should, to whatever they're holding, right? So when their assets are going up and down, you know, Bitcoin may be going up and down, but there's no correlation between them. So it made a lot of sense for them to explore putting Bitcoin on their balance sheet.
So they're basically just using, you know, the interest that they're receiving on their T-bills. They're just kind of rolling it into Bitcoin. So it does kind of feel like house money there. And you mentioned kind of a problem.
If you that's for 1 year, at the end of 1 year, you have a 5% allocation to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
If rates stay where they are, right? They are
there you definitely go. Yeah. If it stays where it is, well, that's a whole other can of worms. But you mentioned like a problem with portfolio analytics, which I think is important to mention, which it is all historical data, right? So we can't tell the future. And
but Seb,
I think that's maybe an important thing
to be fair.
Know.
What else do you have? I mean, you can't, if you had a crystal ball that predicted the future,
right,
you wouldn't need any portfolio analytics. You have it all figured out because, you know, you can predict the future.
Yep.
That's a good one. Nobody has that. So you got to at least rely on what you got, which is historical. And you say things like, well, there's no guarantee that the future will look like the past. And I'll just play the flip side. You're right. Bitcoin hasn't even started showing the true asymmetric returns that it could show going forward. So the results are probably going to be better, not worse. Okay, guys? I mean, like, don't always look as it on the pessimistic side. Look on the optimistic side. And this is why I want to expand on this. We say that Bitcoin is a non-correlated asset, but nobody believes that until they look at the numbers. But I think there will be a sea change in attitude. Bitcoin needs to be considered as insurance, and therefore as insurance, it's what's called a long volatility asset, which is to say when the volatility of other assets is picking up, the price of Bitcoin is going higher because it's a long volatility asset. Prior to that, so 99% of the assets in the world right now are short volatility assets, which means when the VIX picks up as measured stock volatility, generally, asset prices are going down everywhere. And that now includes treasury bonds as well, because treasury bonds have become negatively correlated. Well, they're always negatively price correlated to increases in interest rates, but those increases in interest rates tend to kick up volatility across other asset classes. When volatility across other asset classes increases, their prices go down. They're short, therefore, they are short vol assets. But what if long vol assets, which are the beautiful portfolio diversifiers, people come to appreciate Bitcoin as being a long volatility asset. In other words, insurance on the fiat Ponzi. All of a sudden, the results get even better, right, Rafa? Because up until now, a lot of guys have always correlated, oh, it's a risk asset, either implicitly or non-implicitly. People always thought it was correlated to, let's say, the NASDAQ. Well, that is absolutely changing, and those results will become even more diversified, in my opinion, going forward. That's, you know, that's only an opinion. The only thing you can look at in certainty is hindsight when you backward test, or you use backward testing of your model, historical testing of your model. That's all you can use.
Yeah. But that also bothered me, you know, a lot from my career, that we're looking at past data, right? And, you know, it is what it is. It's a framework. You can adjust and you can change the numbers and you can change the assumptions, you can change all of that. But with that in mind, and a little bit of that, and also what Foss just said about being long the tails, being long volatility, that's why we ended up with the Schrodinger model, right? The Schrodinger model, the goal there is exactly to look at the future and probabilities, right? So I'm going to look at, okay, so in the future, what may happen here? Let's look at the both sides, because volatility cuts both ways, right? You can have very good volatility for you, which price is going up. You can have very bad volatility for you, which price is going down, right? So let's look at the Bitcoin And let's look at the two possible scenarios that we have with Bitcoin on the extremes. One is very easy. Bitcoin failed is going to zero, right? That's an easy scenario to predict. The other one, on the other extreme, which is, I think, the beauty of all of this, is Bitcoin becomes, as you mentioned, Sam, becomes the monetary unit of the world, right? And by in that process, it will demonetize several asset classes. It will demonetize gold, silver, real estate, stocks, bonds, everything that we know is going to be denominated in Bitcoin, right? And more important, a lot of these assets, the value that we have on these assets today, it's not only their own value, their utility value, they have monetary premium to them because the cash that has been, real estate is a perfect example. Real estate is a 320 trillion market in the world, right? $320 trillion. And I would say that probably almost half of it, if not half of it, it's monetary premium. It's people buying second houses. It's commercial real estate that people are buying to, you know, to invest and to rent out. Just in the U.S., if you look just as residential properties, less than half of them are owned by people living at them. So there's a lot of activity going on here of people that are buying this as an investment. Why? Because they need to put their money somewhere, right? They don't have an alternative. If the cash that they left in their accounts was safe and they knew it wasn't being eaten out by inflation, they didn't need to do that, but they need to. So all these assets have a monetary premium to them that it's significant. So, but let's not stop there, right? Say, okay, let's continue with real estate. Let's say Bitcoin captures a part of this monetary premium. Let's say the monetary premium is 50% of this amount, right? So let's say 150 trillion to round it up. And let's say that Bitcoin has a 10% chance of capturing this monetary premium, right? If you assign probability to it, then you can actually get to what an expected value would be of Bitcoin or a fair value of Bitcoin is, right? But let's not stop there. Let's say, okay, let's say this would happen in 20 years. It's not, because it's definitely not going to happen tomorrow, right? So let's put that scenario in and let's bring that to present value. And when you do all of these things, and as Greg says, this is just math, right? It's not complicated, and it's simple math. It's multiplication. You need to do anything else here. And you bring these values to present value, which is then you need to know exponentials, which is a little bit more complicated, but it's not that complicated as well. And you come up with a fair value of Bitcoin with all these assets. And if you go, this is a good example also of how we're doing things at the Nakamoto Portfolio website. So this is all on the Nakamoto Portfolio website. People can click there, can open the framework, and then they can change these assumptions. They can say, okay, I don't think, you know, the probability of Bitcoin capturing real estate is 10%. I actually think it's more. Okay, change the assumptions, right? You're going to see that the numbers change a lot. One of the things that this has helped a lot, and I think it becomes more clear also, is that it proves that Bitcoin needs to have volatility. The volatility is a feature, it's not a bug, because we've captured so little of these assets that a very small change in probability. So the collective wisdom of all of us becomes that, you know, it's not a 10% probability, it's actually a 20% probability, or even less, a 15% probability. The impact that has on Bitcoin price is massive because we're talking about very large numbers, right? The other thing that we're not mentioning here is that this also has kind of like a little bit of a self-fulfilling and a feedback loop process that as this starts to happen, it happens even quicker, right? Because if assets start being demonetized, people are gonna get out of them quick, try to get out quick, and they won't be able to. They're gonna have to go somewhere.
Coming back to the high yield bond example, there was one account in Canada that was a buyer of high yield bonds on a portfolio diversification basis. Now every single pension plan in Canada has a high yield bond silo because they realize the diversification benefits and the return enhancements of a different asset class. The same thing will happen with Bitcoin. The question is, who is the first mover? Because the first mover will get the advantage of the incremental buying power of everybody behind that that decision who is not yet involved. So if you get a 4% exposure in your portfolio, but nobody else has any exposure, but they now need to get their portfolios up to 4% exposure, that incremental buying will push the price so much higher and you're the first one at the table. You benefit by being a first mover. It's also game theory. This doesn't also just apply to pension plans and asset managers, right, Rafa? It applies also to nation, you said it, sovereign. Nation states and sovereigns. So this is very exciting stuff to have this, the ability to change these assumptions on the fly, because people can do their own work. And it doesn't have to be the assumptions of FOSS. It doesn't have to be the assumptions of SWAN. It can be the assumptions of the person using this portfolio in, you know, in isolation. They can sensitize themselves to the potential outcomes and do their own probability analysis and expected value returns. Well done, Rock. Yeah, go ahead.
And Greg, fun story. Like there's a friend of mine, not a Bitcoiner, and we were having a discussion, you know, a few weeks ago around Bitcoin, and it's like, oh, this is never going to work out. Then I tell him about, you know, Bitcoin has a probability of demonetizing all these assets. Blah, and he's like, well, you know, I don't think there's a high probability that this happens. So I thought, okay, so tell me what you think of the probabilities, right? And then he tells me the probabilities, like, oh, I think real estate is a 5% probability. And I asked him, how much do you think that it's a monetary premium real estate right now? And then he is even more bullish than I. He said, oh, I think 60% of the, it's monetary premium. And I said, okay, so if you look at real estate only, forget about other assets, right? Real estate only. And I use your assumptions, and I'm not using my assumptions, I'm using your assumptions. Today, Bitcoin should be priced at the 5x of what it is right now. And he's like, I don't believe it. And then I show him the numbers, and then he's like, yeah, you're right. And I could see that his head was like just, he was trying to find an argument against it, and he couldn't find it.
What is
like,
asset
maybe you're right.
It's a probability distribution, and nobody knows. Well, the only thing we know for certain, 100% certain, that fiat money will continue to debase. That's 100% certainty, because that's only math. The question is, what assets do you need exposure to protect yourself against that certainty? And when you start talking about, I'm going to capture X percent of, you know, you talked real estate, Rafa. I think the more exciting one is actually global debt, okay? Because global debt's $400 trillion and real estate's only $300 trillion. So you say, I'm going to take this much of debt, I'm going to take this much of real estate, I'm going to take this much of equities. And then you're talking real, you know, let's just play a game. There's $900 trillion of total global assets. If Bitcoin gets $100 trillion of those $900 trillion, which is less, you know, it's 1/9. It's a slightly above 10% penetration of total addressable markets. What is 100 trillion divided by 21 million? Oh, that's now sort of interesting, because all of a sudden it's $5 million more. It's over $5 million US per Bitcoin in today's dollars. Giddy up, people. We're worried about the next $5,000 move in Bitcoin. And we have a model here that says it should be $5 million. This is where people need to understand why you have to have exposure to this asymmetric return opportunity.
That's exactly right. In our base scenario, which again, it is what it is, but in our base scenario, which I think it's conservative, Bitcoin should be ready to be 20x from where it is right now, today, right? To justify, you know, a scenario that I think it's very, very, very conservative. If you're more bullish, then again, it can change the assumptions. Just put the 100% probability that it captures everything, and you see what happens, right? The numbers are mind-boggling.
But Sam, you can do it, and it's sort of that. You know, all we have to do is tell people, play. It's like a Nintendo game. You know, you can play that game however you want, just as long as you experience the different outcomes according to your input assumptions. Now, someone's going to go there and say, I'm 100% certain Bitcoin's going to zero. And I'll say, you can't be 100% certain. But if you truly believe you're 100% certain, don't manage your own money, because you have no clue how to manage risk. You cannot predict that with 100% certainty. Yet Peter Schiff will insist he's 100% certain. That's why you should not give Peter Schiff any of your money to manage. He is a very bad risk manager. Full stop.
Yeah. So you can check out the Schrodinger's model. Basically, when we talk about monetary premiums of these different asset classes, like when it comes to real estate, what we're talking about is what amount of the value is just because of people investing in it for investing's sake, basically using it as money instead of the utility value of using it as shelter. And Bitcoin has superior monetary properties. So the idea is that it will eat the monetary premiums of these other asset classes over time, at least percentages of them. And so you can actually play around with, well, I think it's going to eat that percentage of real estate, the monetary premium, over this amount of time frame. And you can kind of play around with your own assumptions and come up with what maybe the fair value of Bitcoin should be today based on those assumptions. So you can go check that out. The other framework,
Sam,
that's on.
Before we move to another one, just one thing I encourage people to take a look. Probability by itself is a whole rabbit hole that, you know, I'm actually thinking about writing something just about this, because the way we each of us, you know, human beings have evolved to actually be good at predicting scenarios, right? We don't go, when we were cavemen, we wouldn't go around the corner that we knew a lion was there. So we kind of are assessing probability that, you know, this part of the woods, you have more lions. I'm not going there. I'm going to other places, right? So we are probably the only species that is actually good in looking and trying to predict scenarios. So it's embedded with all of we do, but probability, there's so many different things, you know, and the Schrodinger model, the name Schrodinger model comes exactly from the way that the quantum mechanics looks at, and quantum physics looks at probabilities, right? And seeing that things can actually be in two stages at the same time. And I'm not gonna get into this, but just I encourage people to look into Bertrand's paradox and different things in probability. It'll blow your mind. That I guarantee it will make you look at the financial markets and everything in life very different than how you're looking at it right now.
Yeah. It's all a game of probabilities, right?
Yep.
And I like Bitcoin's odds.
They're very good.
But yeah, they're very good. You know, the other framework on the Nakamoto portfolio is based off of Foss's work, looking at credit default swaps. And Foss, you describe how Bitcoin will be viewed as insurance one day. There might be a decoupling of how people view it compared to other risk assets. And you always said that Bitcoin is default insurance on a basket of sovereign. And Hafa here basically built a model around your work. And so, I mean, maybe just talk through that framework and this, what you think of this new tool that you have that based off your own work. It's got to be pretty cool, right?
I always wanted to do it myself, but I'm no, you know, I used to be a pretty big wizard in something called Lotus 123. If you can imagine that, Lotus 123 was the precursor to Excel, and I'm okay with Excel. Yeah, but here's the thing, like I can still write macros in Lotus 123 in my head, but I can't do it in Excel. But here's the point. You this is a beautiful tool that relies on the assumption that Bitcoin is actually an insurance policy. And whether or not it's just my idea, Mike Novogratz tweeted it out the other day. Love him or hate him, he's a guy with a little bit of a credit background. But I believe that the credit guys are the smartest guys in the room. And they understand the fiat Ponzi better than anybody. They just don't have the solution. And slowly but surely, they are coming to appreciate Bitcoin as being credit default swap insurance on various fiats within a basket. And you can say, well, the United States is highly unlikely to default. I will agree it's highly unlikely, but it's not certain. And then as you go down the spectrum, there's countries that are defaulting all the time. So you look at Argentina, that's defaulted four times in my career. And you can say, I can see why Argentina would be a very good candidate to own Bitcoin if you're an Argentinian. All of this is possible to calculate intrinsic value of Bitcoin based on a basket of fiats. And Rafa does that. Thank you very much, sir. Based on the idea that every nation has funded and unfunded debt obligations that can have an intrinsic value of their default protection based on open market credit default swap spreads. And these things are not manipulated, okay? Everyone says, oh, they're not. It's not a big market. They don't understand the CDS market. Predominantly people that are making those comments, Rafa, those are equity fools, okay? These equity guys are making these assertions that the CDS market doesn't matter, and they've never traded CDS in their whole lives. Once again, the fool at the table is traditionally the equity clown. So thank you for modeling this. It's one of many different models that can support an intrinsic value of Bitcoin. And when Novogratz tweets it out, I'm sort of flattered. Whether he got the idea from me or not, I don't care. But a guy that really gets it, one of the best credit managers I've ever come across, a guy by the name of Steve Tannenbaum that runs a big New York-based credit fund called Golden Tree Asset Management. And he owns Bitcoin for exactly that reason, because it is insurance on the fiat Ponzi. So now we can actually go and say, hey, here are the assumptions of CDS, the spreads. You can play with them thanks to Rafa's model. And this is the intrinsic value of Bitcoin. One more valuable output factor in many different models that can calculate the intrinsic value of Bitcoin. So thank you for doing that, Rafa. I'm incredibly flattered.
Yeah.
My pleasure. The model is good. I think, as you said, it's another tool to show what the price of Bitcoin could be, right? So in isolation, any of these things, I think, has some value, but not a lot of value. But I think we're building something that when people are going to go there, they're going to say, okay, there's this pillar and this pillar and this pillar and this pillar. And it's going to become harder and harder to ignore that this actually has a place in a portfolio. Just Sam, I'm just going to tell a quick story, which I think ties a lot with what Greg just said. So 2007, right? Right at the beginning of 2007, a lot of people already knew that a crisis was coming, right? We knew, like everybody in trading desk was saying, you know, that this is all going to blow up, you know, it's unsustainable. All these mortgages are not going to be paid, right? There's a lot of excess in the market. People were saying that, but the market kept going up for a long time, right? You look at the, you know, watch the long short again, and you'll see this exactly happen, right? They put the trades on and they're like panicking that it's not happening. And then
yelling and
gradually and then suddenly. But through that process, I was sitting at that time, you know, I was unfortunate to go that at the beginning of that crisis. I was at Goldman. I made a decision to go to Merrill right before Merrill actually collapsed. So I saw all of that through the eye of the storm. But the point's not that. The point's when I was at Merrill and then at Goldman, I was providing a lot of solutions to clients. And a lot of them were calling our desk saying, listen, I want to protect myself against, you know, the collapse. The collapse is coming. What should I do? And we went through at our desk through an exercise. And this started at Goldman for an exercise at looking at several asset classes, everything that you can imagine. We looked at hedged, right? So we looked at the typical, we buy puts on the S&P, right? That was one that we looked at, which is first thing that you think about, right? Oh, we'll buy gold. We'll buy, you know, different commodities. We'll look at different things to buy. And we couldn't find anything that that would actually satisfy the scenarios that we were looking at, right? Because we were very pessimistic. We knew that, you know, things were going to blow up significantly where they were. S&P puts, they were okay, but they were very expensive. You also have to roll them from time to time. So, you know, that didn't work very well. Funny story about gold. We had one investor particularly that had massive position that wanted to buy gold. He was convinced that gold was going to be the hedge for the crisis, right? So we looked at it and said, okay, so you can just buy derivatives on gold. And he's like, no, because I don't know if you, and he was right, I don't know if you guys are going to pay me out if this goes bad, right? I want to own real gold. So we went through the process of trying to get him real gold, right? So I said, okay, so let's get you real gold. And it's like, okay, but I want to see the gold. So we found a place in Switzerland he could go in, look at the gold, see that the gold was there. Then he comes back and we're like, okay, so you're satisfied. You saw the vault, you saw the gold. And he's like, no, I still can't, I'm not convinced, because I don't know if they're just going to say tomorrow somebody else is going to fly there and they're going to say that gold is their gold. I didn't verify that it's real gold. So how can I be certain that that's gold? You know, fast forward again, we looked at different alternatives. What this investor ended up doing was buying credit default swap protection on investment grade bonds. So if you think about the capital structure of a company, right? So a company goes under. First thing that they are not going to pay are equity holders. So the puts, of course, are going to be worth because the stock price goes to zero, you made money. But after they didn't pay that, so they collapsed, the next thing that gets eaten up is their credit, their bonds, right? Their bond obligations. Mm-hmm. So bonds are like, credit default swap on bonds are like the ultimate really out of the money protection on the system. And then if you're talking about investment grade bonds, these are really, really out of them because these are the best bonds out there, the best companies out there. You're buying, you know, credit default swap protection in Apple and good companies at the end of the day, right? So we looked at that, and that was the trade that he ended up doing. And he made a fortune because he was paying very little when in the beginning of the crisis. He was paying something like 30 basis points in the beginning. And these things blew up to like 200 basis points. I'm not going to go through the mathematics of that, but that's a lot of money when you talk about credit default swaps, right? So, you know, credit is a good, it's a great market to buy protection on at the end of the day, right? So this it puts, I think, more validity on the, when we look at CDS as a way to hedge really out of the money protection in the market.
Yeah. So credit default swaps are basically insurance contracts on, you know, if it's a sovereign bond on that sovereign defaulting. And right now we have, you know, a lot of worries in the markets about even the U.S. defaulting with this debt ceiling fiasco, where you have these credit default swaps spiking because people are starting to like bet on those contracts a little bit. And that's a way for us to kind of estimate the value of Bitcoin. So you can kind of change the estimates. Well, I mean, guys, this has been a good conversation. I think that's probably a good place to stop. Unless Hafa, you wanted to add anything about the CDS model a little bit more, but it's been a really fantastic conversation so far. I'll let you guys have some like final comments. So I'll throw it to you, Hafa, and maybe tell people where to find you as well.
Yeah. So final comments, and then I'll tell you where to find me.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we are watching the end of an extremely slow train crash, right? This train crash started in the 17th century when gold started to be deposited with goldsmiths and they issued notes for people to start negotiating, right? Then we had the gold standard that worked well for a couple of centuries until the 20th century. But then we saw that the gold was very good to move value a long time, but not a long space. And we saw, I don't need to go through the details, Bitcoiners know this very well, right? The Gold Reserve Act of 1932, right? And then we said 1971. So this is all just going in one direction, man. And then we fractional reserve system that got created based on that. It's not even fractional anymore. Since 2020, the banks don't need to have any reserves whatsoever with the central bank. If you look the direction this is going, it's not a good direction. I think my personal opinion is that this is irreversible. And, you know, if we add to that the amount of debt that we have in the world, how that's escalating, the whole issue of interest payments that we've seen, I mean, all of those points, this is that's why this is such a good, I think, asymmetric bet at the end of the day, because the probabilities in my mind are just getting higher and higher that a very big event is going to happen. And if it doesn't, it's actually good because it means that, you know, the system got fixed. I pray every day that that happens. I don't think it will because we have the history is not on the side of politicians and how the system is actually derailing again since the 17th century. Just to finalize, people can find me on Twitter at Alpha Zeta with two A's. And at Swan, you know, I'm going to be in Miami next week. If people are around, just stop at the Swan booth, say hi. It would be a pleasure to see everybody there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really tempting for these politicians when they have a button to press where they can print more money. It's usually what happens, right? It's the easiest thing for them to do.
It's happened. It's happened through history, and people tend to have four-year planning periods. They will not take the long-term difficult situation. They will pull forward gains for the benefit of the present at the expense of our children, and that's really the unfortunate part of this. But I'll just summarize, if I may, because I've been going through some dead zones, and I might drop here. Thank you very much for having me, guys. I'm so impressed with the talent in the Bitcoin community. Rafa is a example of this, that at the end of the day, a very talented Wall Streeter who's come to the to see the light, okay, the orange pill light. And as we get more and more of these talented individuals, it'll be easier to sway the old guard, if you will, because people implicitly know there's something wrong with money being printed out of thin air. As your Congressman Brad Sherman said, with a clown face, we're the U.S. government, only we are allowed to print money out of thin air. It's just so disgraceful that these politicians take for granted something that is actually theft from the future of our children. So thanks for this opportunity to speak with some very cool talent. And I'm very comfortable saying this tool will help to orange pill masses because they speak a language that this tool also speaks, which is drawdowns, value at risk, things like sharp ratios and volatility, and most importantly, enhanced returns with reduced risk. Can you tell me a better opportunity to provide pension plans that are currently underfunded? Okay. CalPERS has a 72% funded rate, which means 28% of their current obligations will not be met unless they increase their portfolio returns. How are they going to do that? Finding new assets like Bitcoin, which will enhance portfolio returns and actually reduce risk. It's that simple, people. Managing money is not that difficult if you have the guts to look outside of the box that you're currently put in. Thanks again. Love from Canada, guys. I'll talk to you next week in Miami. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, certainly less risky for, I'm not a fund manager, but then CalPERS going into leverage is you probably look at Bitcoin first. That's what my guess would be.
Amen. Amen. Well said.
Thanks. Yeah, Foss, thank you. And, you know, Hafa, thanks for joining us. You can check out all the tools we talked about today at NakamotoPortfolio.com. Play around with them. Let us know what you think. And if you're an open source developer, you can contribute to them as well to make them better. So thanks for joining us, Hafa. Thanks for joining Swan. Welcome to the team, my friend. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here, Sam.
If you care about your financial future, you need to check out a couple of our offerings, including Swan IRA and Swan Private. Swan Private is our white glove concierge service where you get a trusted partner on your Bitcoin journey. We offer all kinds of education and research projects, as well as exclusive events to our Swan Private customers. Check it out today at swan.com/private. Also, Swan IRA. Swan IRA is the best way to gain exposure to real Bitcoin in a tax advantage account, like a traditional IRA, a Roth IRA, or rolling over your 401k. So if that interests you, check it out at swan.com/IRA today.